say hey. You're listening to 90.1 KZFR. This can support a community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Jake. This is Say Hey, Chico's only locally produced sports talk radio program. And today it is the day before the Major League All-Star Game, which also means it's the slowest 2 days in American sports. So we're going to do something a little different. I'm going to run a bit of a special here. A couple of select cuts from the book, The Glory of Their Times, the story of the early days of baseball told by the men who played it. We're going to hear from Lefty O'Doul. We're going to hear from Rube Marquard. That'll take you right up to 6 o'clock. So stick around. It's a little baseball history today on Say Hey. Here's Lefty O'Doul.
Francis Joseph Lefty O'Doul was born in San Francisco in 1897. He was born right where they eventually put Candlestick Park in what at that time was called Butchertown. He came up as a pitcher, was not too successful as a pitcher in the big leagues. Later, he switched to the outfield and became one of the game's greatest hitters. He led the National League in batting in 1929 with a .398 batting average. And his lifetime batting average of .349 is the fourth highest in the entire history of baseball. He had a bistro on Geary and Powell, right downtown San Francisco. Everybody in San Francisco knew Lefty O'Doul. He knew everybody. He was the town. He became Mr. San Francisco. He ran that restaurant for many years. He was DiMaggio's closest friend. Mr. and Mrs. O'Doul were the best man and best lady at the marriage of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. And he was also, I should mention, Lefty O'Doul was the U.S. ambassador in terms of baseball to Japan. The reason the Tokyo Giants are the Tokyo Giants is because Lefty O'Doul was playing then in the New York Giants. He gave them their name. He started professional baseball in Japan. He was a revered figure in Japan, easily as revered as their greatest hero, Babe Ruth. When Lefty went to Japan, as he did many, many times, he couldn't walk down the street without people bowing to him, and he was a wonderful person. I interviewed Lefty in his restaurant. Waiters were rushing around getting things set up for the noon meal. Despite it all, O'Doul just concentrated totally on what we were doing. He didn't seem to realize all this hubbub was going on around him. I hasten to add that we became close friends, and I made many trips subsequently to San Francisco and spent a lot of time with Lefty and Mrs. O'Doul. I would often go out there Christmas and Thanksgiving time. On Christmas Day and Thanksgiving Day, Lefty would shut the doors of the restaurant early in the morning. No one was allowed in except street people. People who lived from hand to mouth, people who were broke, addicted to this or that, people who were homeless people. And they were the only people allowed in Lefty O'Doul's restaurant on Christmas Day and on Thanksgiving Day. I was in there because I was a close friend. Everybody got a wonderful meal and everybody got presents. Even me, they gave me a present wrapped up and everything. This is for Larry Ritter. It says for everybody else. This was so-and-so, and everybody clapped. It was great.
What'd your father and mother think about you becoming a professional baseball player?
Well, I forget what they thought. I guess
they were
elated because I was first working in a slaughterhouse. I didn't graduate from grammar school even. They took me out of grammar school and put me to work in a slaughterhouse. I educated myself a little bit so I could converse with people and met a lot of people. And these fellas squawking about conditions and playing night and playing the next day. I used to play Sunday morning in Stockton, get an egg sandwich and go and put the wet uniform on, play in Sacramento in the afternoon, ride 60, 70 miles in a bus. I used to play in Oakland on a Sunday morning, come over in the ferry boat and get a bean sandwich and carry my own uniform and play in Recreation Park in San Francisco in the afternoon, put the wet uniform on.
That was semi-pro?
No, that was professional baseball.
No kidding?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, Pacific Coast League.
I'll be damned.
Yeah. I was playing in Des Moines, Iowa, and you get on a train, and you carry your bats in your own bag, your own uniform, roll it up and carry a uniform. Get on a train with the old wicker seats, and they were burning coal. And you get in the car in July and August and go from Des Moines to Wichita, Kansas, all night, part of the next day. And if you opened up the window, you'd be eating soot and cinders all night. And if you closed the window, you'd roast to death. See? So when you get off that train in the morning, if you had the windows open, well, you'd all look like you had a mad black mask on. Or if you closed the window, you couldn't sleep all night. And these fellas are squawking today and traveling in jets and air-conditioned airplanes and air-conditioned rooms. I played in St. Louis where you'd sleep with a sheet on, you'd be sleeping in a puddle of water. Mm. You get up and play ball the next day. It's certainly a lot softer now than it was. And how can they give these fellas sight unseen without knowing what's inside their body, what kind of a heart they have, what kind of intestinal fortitude they have? You give them $100,000 to sign a contract.
That's a lot of money.
I can't understand it, Dad. I would imagine the Bank of America here would go down to the University of Stanford, get the honor student down there and give him a couple $100,000 and say, someday you're going to be one of the big shots in the bank. Same idea. They wouldn't dare do that, would they?
No.
And after you make good, why, I think those are the fellows that should get the dough. I don't think they should give it to some fellows unproven.
Yeah.
And they throw so much money away. And I led the National League in hitting in 1929 and hit .398 and had 254 hits, broke the record, and I got a $500 raise in Philadelphia and had to play 10 or 12 exhibition games to get our salaries. If a ball club plays one exhibition game a year, why, they're mourning like something happened to them.
What'd you get then, about $20,000?
Oh, are you kidding? I was lucky to get $8,000.
No kidding.
In 1932, I led the Brooklyn Ball Club in the National League in hitting with .368, and they cut me $1,000.
Okay.
See, I was just born 30 years too soon. It was depression. No kidding. I'm telling you the truth.
Wow.
And I can remember, I loved to play. Jesus, when I was playing ball in the big league, my bats were jumping in the trunk. Couldn't wait till I get to the ballpark, you know? Grab that bat. And, of course, I was hitting the streak, and I can see when a fellow's in a slump why he hates to go near the ballpark, see? And I can imagine some of those fellows have been in a slump all their life. Never could hit. I mean, it must be drudgery for those fellows to go to the ballpark. But, I mean, I couldn't wait till I get there.
When you were batting, could you see the ball hit the bat?
Well, I try to watch it as long as I could. See, I think it's impossible. You watch it. You watch it and try to see it. If I put my hand like that, you can't even see my hand, so how am I going to see the bat hit the ball? So this is a blur, see?
Yeah.
I mean, I move my finger. I'm sure that you couldn't see an object hit that thing.
No.
Right? I could see the spin of the ball. You know, I could tell when the ball is halfway up, there's going to be a curve or a
spitball.
Or a spitball, absolutely, or a knuckleball. You can see the ball revolving. See, the ball is revolving. You can see the way it's revolving. I could.
Only missed that 400 by 2 points.
Yeah, I hit closer to 400 than anybody ever hit. And didn't do it.
And didn't.
There's only 8 fellas in the history of baseball ever hit 400. I have the highest batting average of any man living. The rest of the guys are dead. It was an unwritten law when I first started to play baseball. If a batsman hit 3-0 at any time, the next time he came up there, boy, he was knocked down 4 consecutive times. And they're screaming out about the beanball. If they forget about it, they'd be better off. And an umpire going out to tell a pitcher, fining him $50 because you threw at a man. Why, my God, they got an iron helmet on their head, haven't they?
Yeah.
If I was pitching today, I'd see if I could skip them off their head.
You didn't wear helmets those days?
No, I wore a felt hat. And I saw many a ball right in my noggin. How they can get it in there, it's beyond me. How they can...
Well, some good men got hit in the head, you know.
Who?
Mickey Cochran.
Mickey Cochran. So what?
Carl Mays.
So what? Carl Mays and Chapman. One man was killed in professional baseball. How many's killed in boxing and football?
Lots.
Huh?
Lots.
Many and many, right?
Yeah.
And then they're screwed by getting thrown at. It's part of the game. I told you when I first pitched, I knocked my finger off, didn't you?
Yeah.
I came back and pitched in 1921 here, and I hit 15 or 19 batsmen. Hit them. Trying to hit them. You understand?
Yeah.
It was my bread and butter. How many think I missed? You know? Never hit any in the head. Hit them in the ribs, they broke my... And then later on, the shoe was on the other foot. So they broke my elbow, they broke a rib, they hit me in the stomach with the ball, hit me in the shoulders, hit me in the legs... And a ball player will fight himself out of it. See? Drag the ball, try to spike the pitcher. Ball player himself will fight out of it. Why the owners and why the general managers hollering? And the managers, they don't have to go up there and hit, do they?
Yeah.
What are they screaming about? Hey? And you see what they're doing, they're scaring all the ball players in baseball probably about this beanball and umpire warning, going out and warning these pitchers. How does he know that the ball could have slipped, couldn't it? It's only a human being. It's not a lathe. It's not a piece of machinery. It's a human being. And the ball, we could have perspiration on his fingers or something. The ball could slip and hit a man or go behind him. I've seen a lot of fellas throw a ball hit 10 feet in front of the plate.
Sure.
And I've seen a lot of them throw the ball hit the screen. What about the batter when he hits the line drive and hits a pitcher in the head? Ain't nothing said about this.
Which happens, don't it?
Well, sure it happens. The score got hit right in the noggin, didn't he? And Bill Piercy got hit right in the head. I saw him get hit in the head. More pitchers get hit in the head than batsmen.
Yeah. I don't know how a pitcher gets out of the way of some of those.
Well,
which
yeah.
Coming back
but they can hit those line drives back on the pitcher's not supposed to protect himself.
Yeah. They come back.
As I said, the shoe was on the other foot, and they knocked me down many a time. It got so bad, they used to say, well, here you go, Frank. And I used to be ready to duck, and there it was. And every time they come up there, you're going to go down one. Couple of times in a ball game, and Hornsby managing the Cubs, New York team used to give the signs from the bench, and he'd give the signs from the bench to the pitcher, and if the catcher come down with the wrong side, the pitcher would shake his head, and we watched Hornsby give the signs to the pitcher. We knew what was coming, and we'd give the knockdown sign. He'd put his head back like this, shake his head back. That meant you were going to get knocked down. We knew we were going to get knocked down before the catcher knew we were going to get knocked down. They threw every pitch they threw today and more. I used to use licorice and make the ball as black as your hat, and how they hit it, I'll never know. Just imagine Ty Cobb hitting the emery ball, the spit ball, the coffee ball, the mud ball.
What's the coffee?
The paraffin ball. They used to put coffee, chew coffee, and put it in the seams.
Huh.
See? And then they put paraffin, psychotic paraffin, and shine it and make that ball skip. Imagine Cobb hitting 367 lifetime for more than 20 years. So he hitting 400 several times.
Yeah.
So you imagine him hitting. See? Like a fellow said to me, one of these kids said to me, Cobb was about, well, when I told the story, like I'm telling you, Cobb was in about 70 years old, see? One of the players said to me, he said, what do you think he would hit today with this lively ball, see? And I said, well, he'd hit as much as Mays, 345, 346, something like that. And the kid said to me, well, why do you say he was such a great hitter? That he could only hit with this lively ball, this white ball, only 345. I said, well, you got to take in consideration the man is now 70 years old. So, Ty Cobb with this ball would probably hit 600. In the same condition, not hitting the spit ball, the emery ball, the mud ball, the coffee ball. And sometimes they play with the same ball for three ball games.
Yeah, they didn't throw it out so much.
No, throw it out. You score in the stands, hit the stands, throw it back in the ball game. Public never kept the ball. They threw it right out back in the ballpark. That's only been since Babe Ruth, you know, keeping the ball. They always threw the ball back in the ballpark.
You played with Ruth on the Yankees in the 20s.
I was there when he came. He was a wonderful fella. He did more for baseball than baseball could ever do for him. He's the fella that made the high salaries for them. He's the fella that brought them in the ballpark. And why they didn't name it Ruth Stadium, I'll never know.
No.
Because he certainly built it.
And why they didn't name them?
I was with the Yankees when they played in the Polo Grounds. When I joined them in 1919, and they used to play to 500 or 600 people. And as you know, the Giants was a big team at that time when McGraw had them. And Ruth came over there, and the people started coming. It wasn't when the Yankees went on the road. It wasn't, did the Yankees win? How many homers did Babe Ruth get? He was in the minds of every baseball fan in America at all times. And he was a good-natured fellow. He was very nice to the other players on the ball club and other players in baseball. Everybody, all the ball players loved him.
He never had a high hat.
He never did. He was always playing with the fellas and always taking the ice to go to Coney Island with him, riding his automobile to Philadelphia and around.
You played for Huggins and McGraw both.
I played for Huggins and McGraw.
What was the difference between McGraw and Huggins as a manager?
Oh, Huggins was a very timid little fellow, and McGraw was he was a raw line and wonderful guy to me, wonderful, wonderful man. I have a lot of respect for him. He's a great man.
Was it fun to play for him?
Sure was.
Was it fun to play without it, no matter what manager you had, or did some managers make it so it wasn't so much fun?
You see, some managers, when you're going good, why, they'll say hello to you, take you to breakfast in the morning. When you're going bad, they don't talk to you. When you're going good, you don't need the manager to slap you on the back. It's when you're going bad, you need the manager to slap you on the back and take you to breakfast.
Yeah. You never played for Hornsby as a manager, did you?
No, I never did. Thank God.
Yeah. Well, that was a different type of man, evidently.
Absolutely. If he didn't smoke, so he didn't want anybody else to smoke. He'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Everybody's supposed to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. He didn't read a newspaper in the clubhouse. Nobody's supposed to read a newspaper in the clubhouse. Well, I think that's fair to you.
No, it's so
but
sorry.
He liked to sit around the lobby and wink at girls. Like that. Yeah. And he was a great player. The greatest. Greatest right-hander to ever live.
But he never, except for 1 year, he never really could make it as a manager.
A lot of people. Ty Cobb had a tough time being a manager. Because he thought everybody should do it just like he. It was so simple to him. It's like me hitting is simple. It was simple. Just go up there. I could see the ball look like a balloon coming up there. And I was agile. I was fast with the bat. And I had quick reflexes, good eyes. And I wasn't afraid of the ball. And it was simple. But it's not that easy. And so I think it's how you want. I said, why can't you hit?
Did you manage DiMaggio when you were in?
Yeah, I managed him his last year. I'll tell you how great he was. I managed the San Francisco Baseball Club my first year managing in 1935. And he had 397 for me and won the pennant. I got 6 players and $25,000 to DiMaggio. And the next year, 8 clubs in the league, I finished 7th without him.
Mm.
And the Yankees, they got him and they went on to win pennants with him.
Yeah.
Just shows you what one man means to a ball club, especially DiMaggio.
Yeah.
If you haven't got the horses, you haven't got a chance. So that's the story of my life.
If you had to do all over again.
If I had to do all over again, I'd be a ball player without pay. They couldn't have kept me from playing. Plus the thrill of hitting one and a big crowd around. Maybe I was a ham. I don't know. There was a little ham in me. What's used to doing something that no one's looking?
Yeah.
What's used to going to ballpark, empty ballpark, and have a guy throw a great breaking curveball and hit the thing he did out of the ballpark, run around the bases, nobody looking. Wouldn't be a thrill with it.
Nah.
Nothing to it.
Well, I think they're going to start coming in here to eat, so we better break this up. But I sure appreciate spending all this time with us.
Okay. I hope that you got something out of it.
Oh,
I could go on and talk baseball from here to Doomsday.
This is Rube Markwart. Rube is a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He was born in Cleveland in 1889. He arrived in the big leagues 18 years later when the Giants bought him from Indianapolis for the then unheard of price of $11,000. He was in the major leagues for 18 years, from 1908 to 1925, mostly with the Giants and the Dodgers. And his main claim to fame is that he won 19 straight games in 1912, still a major league record. We were in his home in Pikesville, Maryland. Rube lived in a very, very nice apartment house. He was quite well off, married for the third time. His first wife had been Blossom Seeley, the stage star. And when I first called Rube up and asked him, first I wrote everybody a letter and told them what I was doing. And then I called them up and asked to set a time to talk to them. And when I called Rube up, he said to me, he said, well, you're writing a book, are you? And I said, yes. And he said, well, who's going to get the royalties? And I started stammering and stuttering because I didn't have any publisher and I didn't have any idea that there'd even really be a book. And then from the other end of the room, I could hear Mrs. Markwart say, Rube, stop that. And he said, oh, okay. He said, okay, come on over.
When I was a youngster, all I wanted to do is play ball. And my father was against playing baseball. He was the chief engineer of the city of Cleveland. And I would go out and play with the kids, play ball, pitch and everything like that, and come home at night, and he'd say, where were you? I says, playing ball. And he says, now listen, if you have it in your mind that you want to become a professional ball player, get that out. Because I want you to grow up and get an education and go to college. And when you have an education, you can go out and get a job. And if you haven't got an education, you're no good. And a ball player will never be any good. When I grew up, I said, I'm going to be a professional. And I said, you're going to be proud of me. He said, I'll never be proud of you if you're...
How old were you then?
Well, I was only about 12 years old. I wanted to be a ball player. I had a couple of balls in my pocket, you know, and I used to go out and see these big kids playing, things like that. When I got to be about 14 or 15, I was tall for my age, and I used to pitch for them. and friends of mine played with a team called Waterloo, Iowa. They were in the Iowa State League. I used to pitch for their team when they barnstormed. They says, now, if you want to go to the town that we're playing in, Waterloo, we'll recommend you to the manager.
You were only about 16 or 17?
I was 16 then. So they said, we'll recommend you to Charlie Frisbee. He's the manager. Well, in the spring of the year, I got a wire from Frisbee. And he said to me, he says, you've been highly recommended. And if you come to Waterloo and make good, we'll reimburse you and give you a contract.
This was about 1905.
Yes. From Cleveland, Ohio, I bummed my way to Waterloo, Iowa. Freight trains and everything. I got off the railroad station, and the station master, he says, what are you doing here? Come on, get out of here. And I says, no. I says, I'm reporting to the Waterloo Ball Club. And he looked at me, he says, did you ever wash your face? I said, no. I says, I've been riding for 5 days and 5 nights. I says, I'm anxious to get here. I says, where do the ball players hang around? And he said, the smoke shop down the street about a half a mile. So I went down there, and I got in the place there, and Frisbee happened to come in, and I was introduced to him. He says, Keokuk is here tomorrow, and we'll pitch you. I said, you don't want me to pitch tomorrow? I said, after what I've gone through? He says, tomorrow or never. I said, all right. Could I have $5 so I can get a clean shirt or something? He says, after the ball game tomorrow.
Oh, boy.
So the next day, Keokuk team was there, and I warmed up, and oh, I felt terrible. But I had it in my mind that I'm going to show them that I could make good. I went out and I pitched and I beat them 6-1. And that night I thought, sure, by winning a ball game, I could get $10 advance on my salary. So I asked Mr. Frisbee, I said, I showed you that I could deliver the goods. Oh, he says, Keokuk's in last place. He says, well, Oskaloosa comes here. They're in second place. They're a tough team. And if he can beat them, then we'll talk. I said, all right. So I didn't say anything to any of them. That night, went down the railroad station, the same baggage man was there, and he says, what are you doing down here? Well, I said, I'm going back to Cleveland, Ohio. He says, aren't you the kid that pitched today? I says, yes. And he said, why are you going home? Well, I'm so-and-so. He says, you're the best pitcher they've got on the ball club. So he says, now this train comes in at 1 o'clock, and the engine unhooks. In the meantime, I'll talk to the baggage man. When the engine is hooked up, you get in back there, and when it pulls out, he'll open the baggage door and he'll let you in. So that all happened, and when we were 5 miles out of town, he opened the door and then let me in. And so he says, I'll tell you, when we get to Chicago, when we get into the yards, this train slows up so that you're able to get off. But don't hesitate when you get off that train. You beat it out of the yard, because if you don't, there's so many detectives, they'll just grab you and throw you in jail. So I did. When we got to the yards, I got out of there and I got on the street. And about a block from where I got off, there was a fire engine house. And they were all to the fire. It was empty. And they had a big-bellied iron stove. And it was warm, and I just sat in there for a little while. I went to sleep. And the fire department came back, and they shook me and did everything to get me. Said, bum, you get out of here and do this. And I said, I'm no bum, I'm a ball player. You a ball player, where'd you ever play? And I told them, Cleveland around the sandlot. Oh, and they started kidding me about a ball player and everything. They said, where you going? I said, back to Cleveland. You got any money? I says, no. So they got a little pool up of $4 or $5, and he says, on your way, stop and get something to eat. I told him before I left, I says, now, when I come back in the big league, I'm coming out to visit you. And my dad never knew that I bummed my way. He said, you mean to tell me that you were out playing professional ball? I said, no, that's amateur ball. Did you get any money? I said, no, but got my expenses and things like that. In 1908, I went to Indianapolis. And when I was ready to leave, my dad says, now listen, I've told you when you were a kid, 12 years old, 13, 14, I kept preaching to you that I don't want to see you become a professional ball player, but you've got your mind made up that you're going to be one. Now I'm going to tell you, when you cross that threshold to go out and become a professional ball player, don't come back. I said, you don't mean that. He said, yes, I do. I said, well, I'm going, and you're going to be proud of me. So my grandfather, my father's father, he liked baseball and everything, and he told my dad, he said, now listen, when you were a youngster, I wanted you to be something. I wanted you to be a stone cutter, same as I did when I came here from the old country. He says, no, but you wanted to be an engineer. So you became an engineer. Richard's going to be a ball player, and he's going to be a great ball player. He's so determined that nothing is going to stop him. I had a strong willpower in my mind that I could beat anybody that I pitched against. So my first year with Indianapolis in 1908, I broke all world's records. I pitched 48 full games, won 28 of them, had the strikeout records and the least hits and everything like that. And they put me up on the block. And all the big league clubs bidding on me like a horse being auctioned off. And I went to the New York Giants. 11,000. The highest price that ever was paid for a ball player. $11,000. And when the team got to Chicago, I went out to that firehouse. And the only one was there that was when I first got there was the lieutenant. I walked up to him and I says, Lieutenant, do you remember me? Never saw you before in my life. He said, I don't know who you are. Well, I said, remember a couple of years ago, you caught me sleeping back at that stove there. Oh, he says, you the fella that's the ball player? I says, yeah, remember? I said, my name is Marquardt, Richard Marquardt. He says, yes, what are you doing here? Well, I said, I'm in the big league. I told you when I'd get in the big league, I was coming out. He says, who are you with? I said, I'm with the New York Giants. And boy, when the Giants had come to Chicago, he'd have all the kids in the neighborhood, everybody around there. And I'd come out there and sit in front there and talk to him and things like that. Every trip we got to Chicago, I'd go out and see him.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it was really wonderful. So I never saw my dad until about 15 years.
Didn't your father try to get in touch with you all this time?
No. He was stubborn, so was I. So one day, the bat boy came in, he says, Ruby, says, there's an elderly man outside, and he wants to see you. He says, is your father from Cleveland? I said, my father wouldn't go across the street to see me, but you go out and get his autograph book and bring it in, and I'll autograph it for him. So instead of bringing the book, he brought in my dad, and we were both glad to see one another. I said, why didn't you tell me you were going to be out to the ball game? He says, I was afraid to make you nervous. I said, there were 35,000 people there. They didn't make me nervous. Well, I kept him there for 2 weeks, and he had a grand time, and he went home. The photographers and the newspapermen wanted to know the address of my dad in Cleveland, and I told them. So they went to Cleveland, got his picture and everything, and they asked him a lot of questions. And they said, did you ever play ball when you were a youngster? Oh, he says, I used to play ball, but I never became famous like Richard. Well, are you proud of me? He says, why shouldn't I be? He's a great ball player. Friends of my dad, when they see him sitting on the porch, they'd say, well, Fred, you see what your son Rube did today? He said, who are you talking about, Rube? He said, your son Richard. He says, I told him baseball was no good. He even changed his name. When I got to New York, McGraw said to me, when I reported to the Polo Grounds, he said, now listen, he says, all the newspapermen, everybody in New York has got their eyes on you. Paying $11,000 for a man, they think he can't lose a ball game. Cincinnati's coming here Saturday. I want you to do some running, shagging the outfield, and you're pitching Saturday. I said, I think I can beat him too, because I had it in my mind I could beat anybody. So Saturday came, and they had about 50,000 people there. I never saw such a crowd in my life. The umpires came out, and the battery was announced. Bresnahan and Marquardt for the Giants. The whole 50,000 just